Chapter 10. By the time the exhibition wrapped up, Kanu was not sad to be moving on from Lisbon. He had always been fond of the city. It had provided sanctuary to his mother for many years, and much of her own affection for the place and its people had rubbed off on him. But after his time in the embassy, he had no desire to be rooted to one place for very long. As it transpired, Nyssa had a gap in her commitments, so they agreed to be tourists for another 3 weeks. Nyssa, for her part, had identified a number of small museums and galleries they could visit during their travels, each of which contained works by his famous ancestor, Sandeya Kinya.
"Not the real treasures," she cautioned. "They've all been sucked up by the Lisbon show, and it'll take a few months for those pieces to get back to their home collections, but there should be still enough to broaden your education."
"I have a lot of catching up to do,"
Kanu said, but his frame of mind was agreeable and receptive. From Lisbon, they travelled to Seville and Gibraltar, riding the great suspension bridge to Morocco. In Tangier, they visited a small private collection housed in the lower rooms of a salmon-coloured townhouse constructed around the cool geometry of a lovely shaded courtyard. Kanu had been doubtful about intruding on someone's privacy, but the family owners were flattered to have the attention of the renowned scholar Nyssa Mbaye, and threw open their doors accordingly. Kanu and Nyssa were treated splendidly, finally conceding to remain as guests of the household so they might enjoy a little more of Tangier. Their hosts, the Al Aznam family, were born on the moon, but had returned to Earth 50 years ago. After selling a tract of valuable Framara real estate, they moved into art, a shared fascination.
"I'm as pleased as anyone to see Sandeya receive the recognition she was due in her lifetime," said Mr. Hassan Al Aznam, as they dined on couscous in an upstairs room, its walls hung with carpets. "But as a relative, Mr. Akinya, you must wonder how it would have changed her to have received this acclaim when she was alive."
Kanu chose his thoughts and words carefully. They were speaking French, since their host was fluent, and Kanu's French was not as dreadful as his Arabic.
"I barely knew my grandmother," he said. "She visited Earth precisely once in my lifetime, and that was only very near the end of her life. But I can tell you this."
He took a moment to pour more honeyed mint tea for Nyssa and their hosts.
"She did not feel for a second that her genius had been overlooked. She spent part of her life being an artist, and she made a modest living from it. But when the time came, she was perfectly willing to turn away from it."
"It has to be said that Sandeya's position was exceptional," Nyssa put in. "It was her choice to leave the family business, but that money was always there if she chose to return."
She glanced at Kanu, as if seeking his approval. Kanu nodded.
"Yes, she was a struggling artist, but she always had that safety net. And when the time came, she felt she had no choice but to take on her share of the family responsibility. But it was not a surrender. From what I understand, and Nyssa is the historian here, not me, Sandeya could have carried on creating art indefinitely."
"She was prolific enough as it was," said Mrs. Karima Al-Aznam. "Imagine how hard it would be to get to grips with her work if she'd continued for another century."
"Picasso produced around 52,000 works of art," Nyssa said, "and Vermeer fewer than 50. Yet they are of equal interest to us. It's true, though. Sandeya's legacy is already more than enough for most of us, and that's before we start worrying about all the lost pieces scattered around Earth and the solar system."
"I am just sorry she could not share in this,"
said Mr. Al-Aznam.
"It would have been a blessing on her life. What is the point of having all this fame and prestige if you are not alive to share it?"
"You think about death too much," chided Mrs. Al-Aznam,
placing a hand on her husband's wrist.
"It's not a healthy preoccupation."
"I think about death to stare it in the eye,"
Mr. Al-Aznam replied, with a sudden fierce enthusiasm. There was a formulaic quality to this exchange, which led Kanu to suspect it had been aired before, perhaps many times. The Al-Aznams appeared cozily settled in their routines, as comfortable with each other
as a pair of gloves.
"You must tell us again how you came to meet," said Mrs. Al-Aznam. "Nissa," explained quickly, "but I do not think I quite understood. You were married once, and now you have met again because of your mutual interest in Sunday."
"We met in Lisbon," Nissa said, "accidentally. But had it not been for Sunday's work, it wouldn't have happened."
"And you were aware of Mrs. Mbaye's scholarship beforehand?"
Mr. Al-Aznam asked.
"How could he not have been?" asked Mrs. Al-Aznam, as if this was the silliest thing he had ever said.
"Actually, I wasn't,"
Kanu said, smiling.
"It's a terrible confession, I know, but I've really only developed an interest in Sunday since I got home, and it was a coincidence, our meeting again."
"The world still has the capacity to surprise us,"
said Mr. Al-Aznam, visibly pleased with himself at the expression of this sentiment.
"This gives me hope."
"Sooner or later," Nissa said, "our paths would have crossed. In some ways, perhaps, it's not such a coincidence. I developed an interest in Sunday's work because of our marriage, and it must also have been at the back of Kanu's mind, something he meant to look into."
"I'm glad it happened, though," Kanu said. "I didn't realize how much I'd missed a friend until I was back on Earth."
With a certain inevitability, they had become lovers again, a week after their reunion in Lisbon. It was tentative at first, both of them recognizing that their newfound friendship could just as easily be broken as reinforced. Equally, neither had much to lose. If they became lovers and then decided it was not working, no great hurt would have been done to either party. They could still part on good terms, better for the experience. In the meantime, as in all things, Kanu opted to trust the compass of his instincts and hope for the best. Both had changed in the century since their marriage ended. Kanu was much older than Nissa. Very old indeed, even by the modern measure. He had benefited from his merfolk genetic transformation, which protected him against the worst effects of the mechanism's fall. Nissa was less advantaged, but as she approached the turn of her third century, it was clear she had made the wisest use of her wealth and contacts, seeking out the best prolongation therapies available in this harsher, simpler world. They both carried their allotment of scars, inside and out.
"I have work to do," she said, as they were lying next to each other in one of the guest bedrooms. "Too much work, and not enough time. I'm not ready to give in just yet."
"I was thinking back to what Mr. Al-Aznam said. He had a point, didn't he? What's the sense in all this glory if Sunday's not around to be part of it?"
Kanu kept his voice low, not wanting to disturb the other sleepers in the household. It was late, and the night silent. He felt himself at the epicenter of an almost perfect stillness, as if Tangier was the unmoving pivot around which the rest of the universe revolved. Perhaps it was the wine.
"Half of all the great art and literature in existence went unrecognized during the lifetimes of its creators," Nissa answered in the same low murmur. "I know, it's a terribly unfair state of affairs, but that's just life. At least your grandmother wasn't unhappy or starving or persecuted. That's more than some of them managed."
"I'm not ungrateful. We'd both be poorer without her work."
Nissa rolled over onto his belly, straddling him. She began to draw lazy, spiraling designs on his chest, circles within circles, wheels within wheels.
"Reputation's everything to you, Akinyas, isn't it? You've always got to push at the boundaries, looking to the horizon."
"Not all of us."
She stroked his neck.
"What happened to the gills?"
"I didn't need them on Mars, and they're a bother in a spacesuit."
Kanu began to stroke the side of her face, testing the line of her jaw against his memory.
"Perhaps I should grow them back. I think my space-traveling days are over."
"That's a shame. I thought you might like to see my ship."
"You really have a ship?"
A terrible waste of money most of the time. Just sits up in orbit, depreciating.
Then sell it?
I would, except it's not exactly a seller's market right now. Hello, would you like to buy a spaceship? Nearly new, one careful owner. The only drawback is you'll need to spend a month filing flight applications, even if you only want to go to Venus and back. Oh, and there are huge alien things floating out there which might be about to kill us. Most people can't be bothered.
She was working her way down his abdomen, slowly and with care, as if mapping an alien territory.
Besides, I'm going to need it again. All I'm waiting on is the permission.
She had been vague about her plans for the future. Kano began to understand why.
You mean to go somewhere?
Not far, just an exploratory expedition, following up a line of inquiry.
To do with Sunday?
From the right angle, everything is to do with Sunday. I'm serious, though. I thought you might like to see the ship.
I'll think about it.
Well, don't overdo the enthusiasm.
No, really, it would be nice. Where exactly are you going anyway?
You don't get to learn all my secrets at once, Kanu Akinya.
He smiled at her coyness.
Nor would I wish to.
They fell into wordless, near-silent lovemaking, after which they lay back in their bed and tried to sleep. But Kanu found it impossible. After a few restless hours, he rose, dressed, left the room as quietly as possible, and began to stroll the moonlit corridors, stairs, and courtyard of the house. When the shutters were thrown wide, the windows turned out to be wooden carvings, cut with tremendous skill into mesmerizing Islamic patterns. By day, they cast interlocking designs across the courtyard's tiles, developing across the hours like a slowly revealing mathematical argument. At night, the same theorem repeated itself in the paler hues of moonlight. But the absence of glass left Kanu oddly unsettled, as if it had been omitted purely to throw him off kilter. On Mars, a thumb's width of glass had stood between him and death. He had come to depend on the sanctity of glass, to sleep well in its care. He tried not to disturb Nyssa when he returned to their bed.
You can't sleep?
Still on Mars time, Kanu said.
You've been back on Earth for weeks.
It takes a while. Perhaps it's the moon. It's very high and full tonight, and I've never slept well when it's bright. I'm a marine organism. We live by the tides.
You mean you're a creature of water?
Something like that.
Then you should come with me when I take the ship. I'm going somewhere wet.
He smiled.
There aren't many wet places in the solar system.
Do you like surprises or not?
Sometimes.
But after a silence, he added,
surely not Europa. Don't tell me you're going there.
You're no fun. You guess too easily.
It was just a guess.
A cat shrieked across the night. Kanu knew that his chances of sleeping were now hopelessly lost. It would be best to resign himself to that. Before very long, from the telephone masts and solar towers of old Tangier, the faithful would be called to prayer. The Al-Aznams had been marvelous hosts, but Kanu and Nyssa had a world to see and limited time in which to do so. From Tangier, they took the coastal express to Dakar. From Dakar, they crossed the Gulf of Guinea to Accra, riding a sleek old clipper ship that had once navigated autonomously, but whose sails were now trimmed by a boisterous crew of sea-hardened merfolk. In the evening, as the ship cut through wine-dark waters, Nyssa and Kanu sat on deck. They listened to happy shanties about foolhardy mariners and troublesome sirens, and fell asleep under equatorial stars. Kanu slept better on the ship than he had in the household, even when they ran into heavy seas off Freetown. In Accra, there was a museum to visit, a modest public affair but nonetheless bright and well-maintained. They had six Sunday pieces on permanent display, three paintings, two Maasai-inspired sculptures, and a ceramic jug she had bought in a lunar flea market and glazed with her own designs. Nyssa patiently explained the various provenances of these pieces and their relatively minor significance within Sunday's wider output.
Really, she said, when they were out of earshot of the museum's hosts. It's just an excuse to visit Accra. It's lovely at this time of year.
It was. But since Tangier, a disquiet had settled over Kanu's mood. It was with him at all hours of the day. If it began to slip away, the mere observation of its departure was enough to bring it scuttling back. They had been married, but that was an earlier part of his life, and for years Nyssa had barely troubled his thoughts. He would never have wished harm upon her, but equally he had taken no interest in her day-to-day affairs. If she wished to place herself in peril for the sake of intellectual curiosity or academic reward, that was her right. He would have resented Nyssa telling him he was taking an absurd risk by living on the surface of Mars. Now they were lovers and companions again, and it was natural that he should take a greater interest in her well-being. But he did not think this breezy affair would last for the rest of their lives. It would come to its natural conclusion, as their marriage had, and they would go their separate ways again. And in time there would be a day during which he would not think of Nyssa, and eventually a week. And sooner or later, what she did with herself would cease to concern him. And yet, here they were, wandering across public gardens, and the thought of her travelling to Europa alone drove a knife into him. Kanu was staring at the jangle of light through a fountain when his anxiety shifted into focus. It was not precisely Europa that worried him, he realised, nor was it the notion of Nyssa going there in her little ship. It was a fear of not being there as well. They caught up with Fall of Night over the Horn of Africa. It was parked in the orbit where Nyssa had left it, quietly minding its own business. Like all spacecraft, it had a level of autonomy that would have been unusual or forbidden on the Earth's surface.
"I warned you it was small," Nyssa said, as their transfer shuttle completed its final approach.
"I wasn't expecting a hollow ship."
Kanu was floating at a porthole, restraining himself by his fingertips.
"Actually, it's bigger than you led me to expect. Quite an old ship, isn't it?"
"Old is good, they say. It served me well enough over the years. I've splashed out on a few modifications since the last time I used it."
Fall of Night was a charcoal-coloured arrowhead, sharp at one end, and swelling out to a fistful of engines at the other. They docked and boarded, transferring their luggage at the same time. Nyssa completed some basic checks, and then signalled that the shuttle could be on its way. Kanu quickly orientated himself, exploring the living quarters, the two separate cabins, the command deck. For an old ship, Fall of Night was bright and modern inside. There were a couple of skip-over caskets, but they would not be needing those on the 100-hour cruise out to Jupiter space.
"I can tell this is your ship," he said.
"I should hope so. They'll be hell to pay if we've docked with someone else's."
"The smells and colours remind me of our old house. I'd forgotten them until now. You chose everything in here, just as you did back then."
"You never had much of an opinion, Kanu. It was up to me to make the decisions."
There were more system checkouts to complete. Kanu could operate a ship, but it was clear that Nyssa had a great deal more experience than he did, especially with Fall of Night's particular idiosyncrasies. He watched over her shoulder, weightless, as she sat buckled into the pilot's position and reviewed status updates. Screens had petaled around her, bright with diagrams and scrolling tables of numbers, as the ship roused itself to full life. Pumps whirred. Fuel lines ticked. Engines ran through startup cycles.
"Why don't you go and do something useful?" Nyssa asked, twisting away from the screens to look at him. "Make us some chai. You'll be on tea duty until we reach Europa."
Kanu obliged. Nyssa cut in the engines for departure. They broke orbit at half a G, then ramped up to 1.5 until they were clear of you on jurisdiction.
"Can you tolerate 2 G's?" Nyssa asked.
If I start making choking noises, you'll know the answer.
The engine reached maximum sustainable output. They would be on 2 G's all the way to Jupiter, flipping for a thrust reversal a little more than halfway to their destination. Nyssa had programmed in an aerobrake passage to shave off the rest of their speed.
That'll be bumpy, she cautioned, but no worse than those seas off Freetown.
At night, he had the dream again. They were on the converted cyberclipper, weathering the swell off Freetown. By the dream's disfigured logic, the stars were blazingly bright and clear overhead, even as the sea moved to the thrust and parry of storm winds. The merfolk were singing sea shanties. Nyssa and Kanu lounged in deck chairs, a small table set between them. Although the ship rolled and pitched, they were still soldiering on with a game of chess. The game had reached a decisive moment. Kanu was about to move his knight. He reached to pick up the piece, victory in his sights. But the ship tilted, and the knight began to slide across the board, square to square, even though the other pieces were curiously unaffected. Kanu tried to stop it, but his hand moved sluggishly. The knight sped to the board's edge and toppled off. Still, Kanu attempted to catch it. But the knight fell to the deck and continued its slide, out to the drainage slot cut into the ship's gunwales. Kanu rose from the table and went to the side of the ship. He saw the knight drop into the waves. In an instant he was overboard, in the water, chasing the chess piece. It was sinking again, down into still, stormless black. Kanu could not swim fast enough to catch it. The water was thickening, resisting his passage, turning to iron. He watched the knight's descent into darkness, and woke with a single phrase on his lips. Fall of night.